Lena, thank you so much for inviting me as well and having me here. It's really a pleasure to be with all of you. I generally spend my time in Gulu, as she said, which is where I live, and I'm an anthropologist, so I am most at ease when I am spending time particularly with women sitting under trees in the shade and papyrus mats. So right now you're witnessing the anthropologist not in her natural habitat. but nonetheless, I think that we'll have some good discussion today. And actually, on that note, I just want to try and keep track of my time. How long am I supposed to talk to you today?
We are flexible. As long as you're under an hour,
okay.
You're good.
All right. Fantastic. Great. Oops. I'm going to time myself. There we go. Okay. So, the transitional justice is very often talked about as a kind of toolkit, and although many scholars and practitioners working on transitional justice issues are quite quick to emphasize that a model from one context can't simply be transplanted in another adaptation to context, that these issues are quick to emphasize that a model from one context can't be simply planted into another, the adaptations to context tend to be fairly limited. And so a focus on the specific dynamics of the conflict and political exigencies of the particular transition, as well as consultations with communities affected by violence or population surveys, those kind of tend to be some of the main ways in practice that that adaptation to context happens, still assuming a kind of toolkit approach. And there are a lot of assumptions in that kind of an approach. One, that the goals of transitional justice are universally held, that a kind of moral imperative that justice must be done exists, and that indeed that the tools in that toolkit, the truth-telling processes, trials, lustrations, reparations, limited amnesties, can accomplish those goals if an appropriate package is assembled for that particular context. So, even more basic than that, I think that the concept like justice, accountability, and forgiveness are assumed to translate. And what that doesn't do, or often doesn't do, is to ask really important questions like, what does justice actually mean for this particular group of people? Or, after a crime takes place and wrongdoing occurs, what are the priorities and the goals of the people who were affected by it? So my research begins from the conviction that what justice really means for a people after war in this transitional moment is intricately related to what justice means for them in general. Of course, there are different dynamics that are at play in wartime. There's the violence, the scale, the organization, political motivations, and often the instrumentality of violence. And that could call for special approaches of transitional justice mechanisms, which I think of as approaches to justice that requires either a more partial or a kind of more holistic. But there are also really contextual and fundamental ways that people conceptualize notions of crime and wrongdoing, and therefore appropriate responses to it. So by looking at both what in the transitional justice kind of discourse we might call ordinary and war-related situations, it has great value in this contextualization that TJ is looking at that both of those together has a lot of value, and I think it's something that is really necessary in discussions about transitional justice. And you simply can't get that from surveys or consultations where in northern Uganda, for example, people would do this. But let's everyone raise your hand if you want to forgive the LRA. And clearly it's a rather absurd way of understanding very complex notions about forgiveness. And in some cases, it leads to real distortions of different kinds of terms. For example, accountability. The way it's used in the international discourses and yet the way it's understood locally is drastically different. So in my research, I focus on one particular crime or a category of wrongdoing, which is rape. But it's used here as a window into understanding the concept of crime, justice, accountability and healing, and what that means for people who are the closest to violence. I want to, that's just kind of a few words about transitional justice, because I won't really use those terms very much, even though I'm in a transitional justice seminar. I want to start off, actually, let me just go back there for a second. I want to start off by sharing with you two different stories of rapes, both of which took place during the war in northern Uganda, and what happened afterwards. So the first took place when a young woman left her home during the war, and she was going to visit an aunt in a neighboring village. And she passed by a house where there was a soldier sitting outside. She was with a friend. The two of them were walking past, and the soldier threatened them both at gunpoint and raped both of them. The friend was able to escape and ran to a nearby military outpost and called the soldiers, other soldiers, to come to where this other soldier had raped them. And the soldiers rushed to the scene and immediately shot the perpetrator, the man who had done it, as she was there. And her explanation of what happened and her reaction to it was succinct. She said, "He was shot and I was negative." That is, that she had not been infected with HIV. "That was enough for me. He did something very dark. I was afraid that he might have killed me after raping me. So it, that the shooting and the killing of the rapist, was the right thing to do." Now, the second rape story that I wanted to share with you involved a young woman who was raped by her cousin. And after it happened, the woman returned home and talked to her stepmother about it. The stepmother probed into the details to try to find out whether or not forced penetration had actually occurred. Her main concern was actually whether or not sex had occurred and between these two people who were cousins, because that was then an incestual relationship, and not necessarily whether the young woman had wanted to have sex or not. So the concern wasn't with consent, but with with the whether or not sex had occurred. So when she found out that it had, then they called the elders together to decide what to do. And the woman explained that the elders made a ruling that her cousin should buy a goat, and that would be used in a public cleansing ritual. That included sacrificing the goat, and then both of them were smeared with the fecal matter from the intestines. And then they were lectured on the perils of incest by one of the elders. And what she said about this was that it was a fitting punishment, those were her words, because he was a relative. She went on to explain that it was the right punishment because it's what the elders decided, and also because if the rape is cleansed by the blood of the goat, it can never happen again. Those were her words. So importantly, the lecture from the elders assured her that she wouldn't be re-victimized despite living in close proximity with her cousin. Because the goat's blood, the elders explained, it's only potent to cleanse this act of incest one time, the polluting spirits that might have resulted from it. And she knew that her cousin's behavior would be inhibited by that that certain contamination if he ever repeated the act of incest. So clearly these two situations are very different. The circumstances of the rapes were different, and the different responses by the victim to what happened to the perpetrator of each is perhaps not surprising. But the extent of the difference, death on the one hand and then paying for a goat and going through a cleansing ritual on the other, is extreme. And yet in both instances, the woman felt that the response was appropriate. What's most striking to me about these two cases, however, is that the narrator for both is the same woman. And these responses to these rapes tell us a great deal, not just about that woman and whatever the complex mix of cultural, economic, and personal social influences that affected the responses, and also not just about rape and its aftermath. Indeed, I think that we learn something central about Acholi perceptions and practices concerning wrongdoing and justice in general, which in turn kind of form the central thesis of my work here. Both rapes in the stories took place in the woman's early teenage years, and in both she thought they were appropriate. So how is that possible? And I would suggest that her responses to the rapes were less about the acts themselves, but rather the web of social and cosmological relationships in which those acts occurred. So the web of relationships in which perceiving the summary execution of one rapist and the ritual cleansing and forgiveness of another as appropriate is what I term social harmony. So social harmony, as I use it and refer to it, is about a widely shared, highly valued ideal in a Chole society. It's an ethnographic descriptor. It's rooted in observations of a Chole daily life rather than a specific translation of verbal utterance that people say. So by it, I mean to denote normal, kind of normal, and people talk about normal relations among the living and the dead, and an ideal of cosmological equilibrium, sort of social balance of power and moral order. So in the phrase, I want to emphasize good relations. And good relations as the interplay of both social and cosmological forces. It's what's considered, in a Chole they talk about kidmapore, or a fitting way of behaving and coexisting with one another, in it to evoke an appropriate way of life and a Chole propriety. Also related to that is this Chole notion of to be with respect, or bed kiworo, for both the living and for the dead. So how I came to this topic grew out of personal experience. In 2005, I moved to northern Uganda and worked with an NGO called Concerned Parents Association, which is an organization that worked with the Aboki girls. If anybody's familiar with them, this mass abduction of 139 girls. But in there, I worked on gender-based violence programs and on reconciliation and peace building. And also in that time, the ICC intervened just after I arrived in northern Uganda. So in this kind of intervention, it thrust northern Uganda into the heart of global justice debates. And out of that, these kind of two different opposing representations of a Chole emerged. On the one hand, we were being told that a Chole were innately forgiving, they're able to deal with crime through traditional justice, and on the other hand, that they needed and often supported formal justice mechanisms and even international formal justice mechanisms. But it became increasingly clear how very little was actually known about these phenomena in the everyday lives of the people that were caught up in the academic and policy discussions. So what I found is that the supreme concern after crime in the Chole context is not this kind of moral imperative to do justice. In fact, there isn't even a word for justice in a Chole, and that these kind of two different representations misses something really important, which is maybe two things: the profound value of social harmony and a really deep distrust of distanced authorities to dispense justice in their interest. The key questions that people were asking after wrongdoing and crime is how to mend the harm that wrongdoing did to social harmony. That primary moral imperative in the wake of wrongdoing is not necessarily punishment of a perpetrator or individual victims' rights, although those things might not be precluded, but it was trumped by this idea of restoring social harmony. So related to that, though, is that the experience of rape itself and the harm that it causes are predicated on understandings of wrongdoing related to the challenge poses to social harmony. I think that'll become more clear as we move on. Similarly, the appropriate response and remedy depends not just on the act of forced sex, but on the role of the social role of the perpetrator and on the social context. There you go. Just briefly on the kind of methods that I use. We have, I think, a lot of students in the room, and so as you're considering doing research, maybe it's also useful to see what other people have done as well, and what you want to emulate and what you want to avoid. So for me, the most important and kind of the heart of my research had to do with the fact that I lived there and participating in people's lives for a long period of time, and that I wasn't focusing on the war by itself, especially in the aftermath of war. Now people are very keen to emphasize the continuums of their lives, how things have moved on after the war, and as well as before, and the kind of rather everyday experiences that they had during the war. Not just focusing even on violence, but For me, this meant when I came, people were still in IDP camps, and now there's been a transition, and people are in homesteads, and all of the camps are gone. And so being able to witness and be part of that transition in people's lives has been really invaluable, really a privilege, I would say. So that, I also use this word participant reflection instead of just participant observation, because an important part for me is I did all of my research and my writing from Northern Uganda. So as I was writing, I was constantly talking to people who were part of my research about what I was writing about and kind of checking with them and asking for ideas. And so things would be very fresh and reflective, and you know, I'd kind of get new meaning out of things just by chatting with my neighbors when after a long writing session, or indeed I was building this what I call a super hut, because I live in this fantastic grass thatched house that I absolutely love. And as I was building it, I was finishing writing my thesis, and when I had a question, especially about masculinity or something to do with men, I'd kind of go out and start, they were all men, so I would chat with the builders and ask them about their relationships and their wives and things like that, kind of go back and write a little bit more. So. It began, though, with in-depth interviews with the 187 women, and I wanted the women to be the starting point. Rather than following kind of different service providers or justice providers, to start with a random, I actually got population data with these gigantic ledger books and picked out kind of every sixth woman in two different villages to get a random sample of them. But I ended up spending an enormous amount of time trying to find them, because nobody actually goes by their names. Everyone is called the mother of so-and-so. And so then if I really couldn't find, no one knows their neighbor's names. I'd say, oh, now is that so-and-so's wife, or is that so-and-so's mother? And then, you know, I'd have to kind of go back to my the local counselor, village elder, and look, okay, yeah, what's their child's name, and then go back and look for them again. Anyway, that they are the starting point. And so I talked to a lot of women. I didn't know whether they had experienced sexual violence or not. These things would emerge in the context of interviews and then ongoing relationships. And I also, before I embarked on all of this, involved the Chole women from a different village entirely in the design, and talked to them about how they would want to approach these issues and talk about them with someone like me. And was I even asking the right kinds of questions and things like that? So they were part of that. And in those interviews, we explored general topics like courtship, love, marriage in a Chole culture, the kind of control that women had in their lives, decision-making within their homes. And then we talked about the types of injustices they'd experienced and who they would trust to help them deal with those injustices, and then more specific questions about forced sex. And 76 of the women who I spoke with shared having been raped. So more in-depth interviews and participant observation and reflection was done with those women. And those women also discussed what happened after the rape, whether it was reported to anybody, what action was taken, if any, and the outcome. And the women who shared being raped discussed what they thought should have happened, because very often, unlike the woman at the beginning, what they thought should have happened didn't happen, and what they thought they would like to be done to the perpetrator as well as to themselves and more generally. So they were also asked who they trusted most to talk to about these kinds of issues and what helped them the most to recover. There's also kind of ongoing interaction with those key informants, and the key informants kind of came out of that list. But of course, in the course of relationships and life, key informants can encapsulate quite a lot of people beyond those specific ones that identified from that group. I looked at court records, interviewed other people who are working, NGOs that are working in gender-based violence, and it's kind of a situational analysis. There are coordination meetings that I attended at the beginning, although I don't anymore. I started to find them very depressing, because they were discussing the exact same things that they were discussing 10 years ago in most cases, and a lot of it has to do with like planning International Women's Day and things like that. And then discussions with men. They weren't formal. I would oftentimes get out my notebook, but I would kind of never have like a list of questions, because I think people clam up, especially if you want to talk to them about whether, I mean, of course you don't use these words, but basically the way that they do participate in and view sexual violence. But men are surprisingly willing and open to talking about things like this. I find that men in Uganda love to talk about sex, and that's often where we would start and kind of move on from there. So, very briefly, I don't want to dwell too much on the context in northern Uganda, but I did want to say that as I talked to friends and colleagues, these informants in northern Uganda, about what's important for people who aren't familiar with the context to know about them in order to even understand what we're talking about, they didn't mention anything about the war. The thing that they said was, they said three things. What you need to tell people is the way we live, what we eat, and how we marry. And I just thought that was a wonderful, beautiful little microcosm into the way that people, what people think is important, and how they want other people to understand them. Even to understand those three small things, of course, they come in the backdrop of things like this. This is a picture from the first time that I visited, it's not very good resolution, I'm sorry, but it's a picture from the first time I visited an IDP camp in 2005 when I arrived, and that's in Anaka. We may all be familiar, but this kind of political changes and military intrigue that followed Amin's overthrow in 1979, the kind of loyalty and reprisal tended to be along regional lines, and then the NRM government, which came to power, which is still in power, just had elections 1986 up to now, it sparked a number of armed rebellions, and the most enduring of those and devastating of those is the LRA. The Lord's Resistance Army. And the LRA violence, coupled with the government of Uganda's policies, entrenched grievances and social and economic and political divisions. So there was massive displacement, over 90% of the Acholi population, about 1.6 million people. The LRA is, of course, famous for abductions, abducting particularly young people, but not only young people, to act as porters, as fighters, and in forced marriages. Interesting little side note, I don't know if anybody is following Ongwen's trial at the ICC, or if you've watched it. I was watching it in northern Uganda because they have it on big screens, these public screenings, and so it's kind of watching all the people in the room as they react to the different things, and the Ayena, who's the defense lawyer, said what there's, because they'd been talking about forced marriage, the victim's representative was talking about forced marriage, and Ayena, who's Ugandan, got up and said, "Now, there was no marriage in the LRA," and all of the Ugandans where I was laughed, and I could tell in the courtroom that nobody really understood what he was talking about. And basically what he was saying is that there have been no customary payments that have been made, and so there are no legal or socially sanctioned or recognized marriages that have taken place within the LRA. But that, it wasn't lost on the audience in Uganda. Everyone understood there were no marriages, and in fact, as I would say more later, that that's one of the kind of key social harms that the abductions and forced marriages in the LRA had on people, because they broke this kind of normal way of marrying, or transgressed that kind of normal way of marrying. Yes, so LRA abductions. Then night commuting was another kind of big feature of the conflict, where young people would be walking long distances to sleep, and again, not only young people, sometimes it was families, but quite often young people going to safer places to sleep at night. Since 2006, northern Uganda has been relatively peaceful. There were peace talks in Juba, which broke down. I think the end of it, you could say, was Operation Lightning Thunder in December of 2008, when the UPDF and joint forces attacked the LRA, and there's been no talking since then. But people have returned, and different kind of policies have been put into place, like the International Crimes Division of the court in Uganda, where they're seeing Kwayelo, who's another LRA alleged commander who's come back. So things to move on. But I think the three important aspects of this for our discussion today is, one, the ways that the war and forced displacement contributed both to the perceived and the actual peripheral status of Acholi and their distrust of central government. The second is the socio-cultural effects effects of violence and displacement that increased women and girls' vulnerabilities with respect to sexual violence and placed significant constraints on what happened afterwards. So, an important reality that impacts the pursuit of social harmony is that in many ways Acholi has been and remains on the periphery of Uganda, both geographically and otherwise, located from the centers of central government administration and political and economic power. And on that periphery, neither justice nor social harmony is safeguarded by an efficient judicial system that possesses moral authority or moral jurisdiction, as I like to talk about it. And in Acholi, the pursuit of social harmony and then secondarily perhaps justice could be manifested at one extreme of mob violence, and organized revenge, collective killing, or a summary execution, as we've talked about. But in other cases, responses focus on cleansing parties and or locations involved in these norm transgressions, or on the concept of forgiveness, with some similarities to and often merged with Christian theological notions of forgiveness. Cleansing and or forgiveness, however, doesn't necessarily preclude punishment, just that punishment might even be considered well deserved, and thus it might be meted out. But it's typically a secondary goal, pursued only if it can be achieved without significantly disrupting social harmony. Oh, there's another picture of Pabo. See how close they are. So there are two broad areas of concern that this study speaks to, both to crime and wrongdoing, particularly in periods of post-conflict reconstruction on the one hand, and on the other to sexual violence and rape, including but not limited to rape in the context of war. In regard to the second, when it comes to rape in the context of war, quite evocative language describing rape as a weapon of war and the female body as a battlefield is commonplace. Yet, at the same time, scholars note similarities with violence before, during, and after conflict. So how do we understand and explain rape and the relationship between conflict and sexual violence? So this raises but doesn't answer the question of whether rape in war or in peacetime is an expression of cultural forces or an aberration of them, a departure from normal female and male relationships. So reflecting on the lives of women and those around them that I've been made witness to in these last years of looking at this, I would posit that rape is not just violence. It's also sex in all of its complex variations. And it's important for our theoretical understandings of rape within the logic of violence, both in or out of war, because it can only partially be explained through the lens of violence. And a large part of what happens in sexual violence must be understood in the broader frameworks of gender and sex within the particular context under study. So that has implications both for our understanding of the logics that animate violence and practical endeavors to prevent or respond to it. So here, counting rape, in each situation counted for the purposes of this study, though the woman emphasized her protestation, she insisted it wasn't feigned, that she felt that the man knew or chose to ignore her genuine refusal and continued anyway. And afterwards, that she felt aggrieved, and actually the word that is used is that women would use there was almost always that they had a leaky heart. It's a way of expressing sorrow and sadness, as well as anger, actually. Although there's another word that you could use for anger, but it's kind of a conglomeration of all these things. So women in the two project villages who were counted among those who had been raped almost invariably described their experiences as unambiguously forced, and all but a few situations which were characterized by deceit, in one instance, drugs, or really exceedingly coercive environments, they were physically violent. In addition to, it's not uncommon in Acholi to have a rather forceful, what you might call a love fight as part of foreplay, but that often leads to what's understood as consensual sex by both parties. And as such, I don't count it as a rape situation. And for this particular study, the threshold of what counts as rape is determined by the internal threshold of the individual women in the study. So that perspective not only builds on established feminist practice of privileging a woman's own account of the sexual violence that she's experienced, but it also avoids, as much as it's possible to do so, imposing an external or a legalistic Western liberal normative definition of rape. Let me just say something about this slide and these numbers here. I mean, altogether, it means that I should say that I don't kind of claim statistical, I'm an anthropologist, but I think that these are numbers that are actually fairly robust for the particular villages that I chose, but those villages were selected on purpose. I didn't kind of pick them out of a hat or do anything random to select those villages. I think that they are representative in some ways and are characteristic of both kind of rural and some like slightly more urban places. And all the things that go along with that in terms of kinship, homogeneity, and various other things. So I think that they give us an indication that I'm not claiming to speak for all of Acholiland with my numbers. I'm also really wary of putting numbers up on a board because the experiences that fit within this kind of category, say 40% of women who have been raped, is vast. I know there's this kind of slogan in particularly Western feminist activism that rape is rape, but actually what happens within this is that there's a huge spectrum of experience that fits into this category that we're calling rape. And the other thing I wanted to note about this is that so many women talked about having been, when they would say that they hadn't been raped, or that they had not experienced this, they would say not that they hadn't, but they would say not yet. And I think it just underscores the kind of the way that women view their own experiences and situations, their bodies as being always rapeable. However much we might find that problematic, I think it's important to recognize that that's often the way that that representation is problematic, but it's the way that people see themselves and also represent themselves. So what is rape? You see this lovely little placard here that's up in a girls' school about defilement, and defilement, I think, I don't know if it's the same here. In the U.S. it would be kind of statutory rape, so forced sex or sex with a minor. Despite the mix of both simple, legal, or complex and social definitions, what are we actually talking about when we talk about rape? What separates sex that's okay from sex that's violence or a transgression? That prompts the question of where the threshold comes from, if I talked about that threshold. But is it simply the way that women's bodies are made, biologically and inalienable, and or is it something which is constructed? Does it come from a deep embodied sense of being violated or a normative limit that's also a social and legal construct? So there were women who described the rather quotidian experience of being forced to have sex, where rape never ceased to be experienced as a violation, particularly in the context of kind of ongoing abuse or in a sexually violent marriage. They would say that being forced to have sex is something that happens, like literally that's the word. It's a way that you might translate it as normalcy. It's something that happens, they would say. Such experiences suggest limits to the routinization of violence. They can affect the social and structural ways that violence is experienced, but somewhere, at least I reason, perhaps even on the body, there's a threshold and perhaps a universal story of this idea of being forced. Actually, in more recent work that I've been doing, people have talked about non-corporeal rape, so having been raped by spirits or by ghosts, and to me that has challenged this earlier idea that I had about the threshold existing on the body. The more I work on this, I feel that the threshold is existential and phenomenological. That is, that the source of violation is a deeply existential one and can't be reduced to any one thing. Socially patterned or universally shared sense of biological violation. Perhaps rather than saying a biological violation, it would be better to say a shared sense of trespass on the boundaries of their being. and rather than the body as kind of self-bounded with skin, that would take more seriously the Acholi notions of good existence, which, as I mentioned, is a deeply social and cosmological experience. And so it would be little wonder that rape could also be experienced in a more cosmological way as a violation of being, as being is understood. Now, some people have taken exception to applying the word rape to some of the experiences that I discussed, particularly Acholi men, but also some Acholi women, whose rape often evokes a particular moral response, conjuring up an image of a rapist as someone who perceives a woman merely as an object and a target, the act of rape as having nothing to do with relationship, provision, social responsibility, or even love. But instead, rape is imagined as the opposite of and outside of the boundaries of all of those things. But if what separates appropriate sex from sex that's wrong or even criminal is the transgression of this internal threshold of violation that a woman experiences, then this needs reimagining. The different kind of categories of perpetrators that came out of these situations, and you see that the number is 94. I mentioned that there are 76 women who experienced having been raped. Some of them had been raped in more than one situation. So if they had been raped in more than one situation, then that kind of brought the number up. So there were some women who had been raped in three different situations and some two. I don't think I had more than four. But also counted as a situation. So if people were in kind of an ongoing situation, or if there was indeed a gang rape, I counted it as one experience, because it's kind of, it would be impossible to say how many times a husband had raped his wife, because perhaps it had been happening over many years and over quite a long time. So maybe not impossible. She might have been able to enumerate it, but that's what I mean when I talk about a situation. 6% were government soldiers, and that's next to civilian strangers. So you can see that here, the smallish portion here, and those are the, for the most part, this is a bit more complicated than this, but I simplify it for time. That for the most part, those are people who are unknown and outside of the kind of moral community of women. And almost invariably, the women in the study perceived the act of rape as a crime, and they thought that the man should be punished harshly, with both the civilian strangers and with the soldiers. So they had other commonalities that I noticed, the responses to those two groups. There were concerns about health implications of what happened and fear about the possible repetition of rape. In both the categories of what I would call stranger rape, the stranger soldiers and the strangers civilians, the social impact of what happened was limited, and the more personal aspects of the experience were given more prominence. I also compare in my work the abduction which the LRA did in the context of abducting young women and having them be potentially as wives and fighters, or just as wives, and also abductions by some Acholi men with the intention to marry the person that they abducted. So here you can see the largest category, this is husbands, so in the context of marriage, 43% of those, or 40 of them were husbands, and then this is boyfriends. So I haven't separated it out here, actually, because there would be some overlap. But there were, and then this is other known people, 15%. So 10 of the people in the study of these different 76 women had this experience of being, their marriages or their previous marriages had begun in an abduction that they were picked up by the roadside, taken to a house, and kept there for a week, and then later on a marriage was organized, or some variation of that. So bringing those two things together, I think to compare those two, they're have qualitatively similar aspects, but the social harm that's suffered is quite different. And in this context, the word abduction is a very loaded word, because it makes people think about the LRA and the kind of violence that people experienced there. And that comparison might also lead some people to misconstrue the work to suggest that LRA abductions of women were a particularly Acholi phenomenon. And that's certainly not the case. I think a simple consideration of the widespread practice of capturing and abducting girls and women in conflict across the world would easily demonstrate that. But instead, abductions by the LRA to those by civilians are compared here to point out both the differences between the two, which are many, but in particular just mention the kind of cosmological and social harms that people have. The having sex in the bush is considered to have a lot of consequences, and bad things can happen when you have sex in the bush. It's kind of different moral space where you're not meant to have sex. And also the kind of particularly children that came out of those relationships, and they happened outside of the context of customary payments and social sanctioning of relationships. Those are some of the differences that kind of highlight the social harm which took place in the LRA rapes. But there are also similarities, and some of them might be more comfortable to ignore. So by comparing the two forms of abduction, I want to call attention to typically unacknowledged commonalities. In both, a woman is surprised, forcibly plucked out of her environment and interrupted in ways that she was unprepared for and forced into a relationship and new life which she didn't choose. And it's my intention and hope in doing that it might provoke a reexamination of sometimes ambivalent or even apathetic attitude towards violence against women. I just want to talk about this very briefly, but I think it's important when we're talking about this, well, one, just to mention that you know, there were 60% of women who talked about very nice relationships with men, and even the ones who had been raped often also had other relationships that were very loving. But it's important to note that, but it's also important to note that the individual and social perceptions of rape grow out of a basic understanding of love and sex and their aberrations. So in Acholi, these are just a couple of things that I wanted to highlight about notions of sex, that there's this metaphor, which is very common, where people will talk about food as a metaphor for sex. A man might talk about having side dishes, to talk about affairs outside of marriage, where his wife is the main dish, that you need to have a variety in your diet in order to satisfy your appetite. There are so many different kinds of analogies or metaphors that I kind of could give there. One of the more troubling ones was a police officer who I spoke to, who talked to me about how he really sympathized, especially when poor men would come in and were rapists, because he would say, well, they clearly couldn't afford to get a woman or to support a wife or to give gifts to a girlfriend or to buy an experience with a sex worker because he's so poor. And so he was like a starving man who was stealing food. So there's that idea that it is as essential as food. And the woman in this case is the food and is satisfying the man with her body. It obviously also has an underlying implication that it downplays feminine sexual desire, that men are the ones who need the satisfaction. It would be also difficult to overstate how important children are to the process as a way of cementing relationships. Acholi youth are encouraged to have sex before they get married, they're meant to play sex, that's the word that people use very often, because you need to know whether or not the person that you're going to settle down with in a marriage will be able to produce children. And there's a belief, young girls are encouraged to check whether or not men are impotent or not, because there's a belief that, you know, if a man erects, then he can also produce children. So if he has any problems in that area, then it wouldn't be a suitable marriage partner. But marriages that don't have children are looked at as being very tentative, and the women are kind of considered in a more liminal status. And then sex for pleasure is secondary to these things. Sex as a kind of foundation for for social harmony is that it's not, when I say sex, I'm talking about sex in the structure of customary payments that go on in order to socially sanction sexual relationships. And when that happens, it establishes identity both for the woman who will change identity, and the kind of foundation of her identity, where she will be buried will be different, where her children will belong will be different, who will be called upon to intervene on her behalf, and to kind of stand up for her. The names, as I was talking about earlier, the mother of so-and-so, it's a way of locating and anchoring people in this in a social space. It's about social belonging. Someone said to me that you can't understand love in a choli if you think that it's between two people. And I just thought that was a really nice way of putting it, very succinctly, because over and over again I see that you have, it's a very social phenomena. So what constitutes sexual wrongdoing in a choli society? I'm really bad at graphics. Someday somebody should help me. but just the reason why I have this up there is because I wanted to kind of show that there is an overlap between social understandings and kind of legal definitions of things, but they're not kind of together, but they do sometimes merge. And then very often what you would see is that people might pursue a kind of legal case maybe only if they're kind of in the space that overlaps. Actually, I don't know, we'll get to that slide, but it's about how people responded to different kinds of sexual transgression. But maybe just to mention a couple here. And also, even though I'm really bad at graphics, my other reason for not doing it is that these are moving targets. So, you know, a circle kind of looks like it's a bounded thing, but social notions of things are changing all the time. It's different from one person to another, one clan to another, yesterday and tomorrow. It's like these things they're pervious and they're changing and they're fluid. But nonetheless, I think that I could still mention a few things that are generally true, which would be, for example, like masturbation, not a sexual crime, but it is considered a sexual transgression because it doesn't result in children, and because it's a man pleasing a man. Women are not really believed to masturbate, but if you're a man pleasing yourself, then that's a homosexual act. Adultery is no longer illegal in Uganda, but it would be considered a crime if it was a woman doing it, but not a man. I mean, sorry, it would be considered a transgression. Same sex would be here, kind of regardless of whether or not it was consensual. Marital rape, so rape in the context of marriage might be a crime, but it wouldn't be considered a transgression. Sex in the bush, as I mentioned, the bush is this kind of different moral space where you're not meant to have sex. So if it was non-consensual sex in the bush, then it might be a sexual crime. But if it was consensual sex in the bush, it wouldn't be a crime, but it would be a sexual transgression. So just to give an idea for how these things kind of relate with each other, one that I think is important to mention is sleeping with a child. So sleeping with a child is looked at in a choli context, they would refer to someone who sleeps with a child as a wizard. It's a very dark, dark thing to do, and so that would be reacted to very strongly, and it would be both a sexual transgression and a sexual crime. But it would be a young child. If the girl already has breasts, then it might not be looked at as a transgression in this notion, but it would be a crime still, because as we read on that little placard, sex with the girl under 18 is considered defilement. I need to go a little bit quicker, don't I? Yes, okay. I'll go through this very briefly, but I think it's really interesting the kind of language that people use when they talk about these experiences. The notions of rape and the languages that people use and as well as the notions of consent. So we've talked a bit more about notions of rape. And the notions of consent, as I mentioned, that, you know, with these circles, you kind of get a picture of what does define it. Location has something to do with it. Age has something to do with it. Whether or not it produces children has something to do with it. All of these linking back with notions of what a Acholi love is meant to be like. But the most crucial thing, I think, for a Acholi is that sex is meant to take place within, or at least with the intention to pay, certain kinds of customary payments. So if those customary payments are made, or there's an intention to pay them, then that's one of the kind of key things that distinguishes sex that is wrong and sex that is okay. So like even though that's the case, there are still ways of communicating consent. So people will talk about whether or not sex was in the yo mewinye, or like a way of negotiation, or whether it was forced. And forced is often the word that people will use. Here with the notion of rape, this first thing that I have here is often the way that rape is translated, buru tek tek. And what I think is interesting about that is that I would argue it's actually not a kind of category of wrongdoing, but it's a description of the sex. So buru means to sleep, and then people don't actually usually use the word to have sex. They use this word to sleep with, right? So then they would say to sleep with hard, hard. Tek tek is like something hard, something strong, something forceful. And it's more of a description of the sex. So people might say, yes, he slept with me hard, hard, but they might just be describing to you how the sex was rather than kind of saying he raped me. Buru gufo gufo, the gufo gufo, it means the same thing as tek tek, but at least what I've been told, I don't speak Swahili, but it's supposedly it's Swahili. And sometimes people would code switch. So they'd be speaking in Acholi with me, and then they would switch and talk about, and not talk about, but use the word rape. So be describing experience, and then sometimes they'd stop and say, that was rape, by the way. Just to try and like, oh, just to make sure that you understand what's going on, they kind of switch to the rape. Or it was to kind of link it to an idea of rape that had been influenced and introduced, perhaps, by human rights campaigns and these gender-based violence prevention and response things, the radio, and various other things that people have been exposed to. In fact, lots of people would tell me, oh, rape never used to be here in Acholi. It's this new introduction because now we all know about it. But it didn't used to be there. And I think part of what they're talking about is this particular notion of rape, but also what they're talking about is that there are actually a lot of increased opportunities for stranger rape. So that particular kind of notion of rape as being attached to like a stranger doing it, in the Acholi context in the long distant past, of course there were some strangers around, but there weren't that many. And the kind of urbanization, the IDP camps, and all of these things have made the interaction with strangers a much more everyday part of people's lives. I'm going to kind of skip over some of those, unfortunately, just for the sake of time. But just to talk the notions of consent, people talk about relatives investigating or giving blessing, and so then that would be a notion of consent. Or going to a solitary place. So if you just go someplace where it could happen, then you should expect what happens there. Not making an alarm, and that's like, that's making an alarm. So if you didn't do that, then you were probably up for it. Gifts, if a girl gives gifts to a man, then that's a way of signaling that the next time they're alone, she's ready. You can see it in the eyes. So many people would tell me that. And I must confess, I didn't ask what you could see in the eyes exactly until I'd heard it quite a number of times. And I sort of assumed naively that it might mean quite similar thing to what I might do if I was going to show it with my eyes. And it's kind of, take me to bed eyes. And actually, and you like look at someone in the eyes, and they said, no, if they look at you in the eyes, then she's angry and she doesn't want you. But if you look down at the ground, then you know that she's feeling shy and that she really wants you, but she doesn't want to show it. But the troubling thing there is that some people say, oh, no, that's in the village that it's like that. But in town, girls will look at you straight on in the eyes. And so it's a very confusing and fluid way of indicating consent. And then, of course, there are physical signs. And what I would kind of really probe for the details of that are talking about of being wet in between the legs. So obviously there's quite a deep degree of intimacy that's already taken place by the time you know whether or not a woman is wet or not. so commonly I heard that you don't really know for sure the first time because of this this practice of pretending like you don't want it and kind of fighting somebody off, and that love fight foreplay that sometimes happens at the beginning of relationships. And that seems to be more the case sort of deeper in villages and less the case in towns. But even so, it's a kind of ongoing thing. So people would say, yeah, this, if she wants a second round or if she comes back a second time, then she must have consented the first time. Marriage is looked at as permanent consent. And an interesting kind of newer phenomenon is that if you go for HIV testing together, then that's looked at as a way of indicating consent. Isn't that a lovely picture? I should take that out though. Okay. I don't know that I have time for this, but actors, just very briefly and just to kind of show you what's here. These are the actors that women said that they would involve after rape on the top. So I asked all of these 187 women this question. And then the other one is the actors that were actually involved in those 96 different situations that I talked about earlier. So you can see that most women thought that they would talk to their relatives about what happened. And this one is the local counselor, one of the village level elected leader. And in fact, I think just visually it's striking that so many more women didn't tell anybody at all about what happened. And but still, the group that was most involved were relatives. It's quite an obvious point, but still an important one, I think, to make, because it underscores the importance of looking at what people actually do, as opposed to hypotheticals, what they say that they would do in situations. And unfortunately, very often, particularly in a kind of transitional justice context, we ask hypothetical questions, and that's what informs our understanding of people's priorities. I think it's important. It also has to be kind of taken with a grain of salt. What people actually do doesn't necessarily reflect their priorities. It's also constrained by their circumstances, but it's still a part of the equation. Responses to rape. This is no action at all was taken. That's 53%. 3% was women's medical treatment, which is really sad. 3% of the people were shot. Interesting to mention there is that they were soldiers. All the people who were shot were all soldiers. Two of them, I think. 6% were imprisoned. And there, let me just mention, out of all these 94 cases, only one actually made it to a court of law. One out of 94. And it, by no surprise, is one of those situations that fell in that center of the two circles, where two men in their 20s raped an 11-year-old girl. And her father had the means and access to pursue a legal recourse. And they were people who were strangers, which I think is worth mentioning, because they were kind of outside of this moral community that the family had. 10% of the result was separation, so in the context of a boyfriend or a marriage. And then 18%, you know, a marriage or a payment was made, so kind of trying to put right the social harm of having forced a woman to have sex, usually producing children with someone, and that's the one way of doing that is by not producing bastards, as people use that language, to make the child a legitimate child and to take responsibility for your actions by taking care of the woman. At 3% was beating, and 4% there was some kind of a ritual that took place, which is also, I think, worth mentioning, because there's a lot of talk about rituals and the importance of rituals, and I don't think that they're unimportant, but very often their importance perhaps exists in the ideals that they represent, and not necessarily in the actual practice of them. Final thoughts. It hasn't been my purpose to build a theory of rape. However, I do think that the experience of women that I encountered over the course of the study and the manner in which they expressed those experiences to me inspire some theoretical reflections that might offer broader insights into rape. and what happens after rape, particularly rape that occurs in the context of war and its wake. So the most important of those being the argument that any grounded understanding of rape and the responses to it must examine the interplay between theories of violence and theories of sex within the context, the particular context that's being investigated or intervened on. And coming back to the question that we posed at the beginning of whether rape is an aberration or an expression of cultural forces, the experiences of people in this study suggest that we can't really understand or appropriately take action to prevent or respond to rape, which is simplistically understood as either a rupture of norms, such as those envisioned in the kind of enemy woman or the weapon of war, stranger rape discourses, or as a continuation of violence against women, the kind of micro strategies of patriarchy. And Veena Das captures really well this tension between the two ways of looking at and understanding this kind of violence. So she reflects on the violent events, particularly sexual violence of the partition in India, and discusses how they were at once both. The magnitude and magnification of violence that took place during the partition, and perhaps in the war in northern Uganda, occurred in a state of exception. But while both wars created something new and exceptional, they didn't come from nowhere. In both places, it was, as she says, anchored in imageries that already haunted relationships. And there's a tendency in responding to sexual violence to only or primarily give attention to sexual violence that constitutes a rupture, and that shocks the conscience is what transgresses widely shared norms. Yet, much of the sexual violence that women experience takes place within the bounds of prevailing norms. So, cognizant of the differences between civilian and combatant rape, which transitional justice tends to order as ordinary or war-related rape or crime respectively, this study indicates that a deeper understanding is gained from appreciating the context in which notions of justice are formed, rather than looking at crimes of war as divorced from the rest of lived reality. So from interpreting the experiences of Acholi women who were raped by civilians and those who were raped by combatants, it's clear that both individual and collective Acholi conceptions of crime, accountability, and appropriate ways of redressing wrongdoing aren't discrete to the transitional moment. Rather, they reveal consistent understandings of sexual crime as based on notions of appropriate sexuality, the purposes of sex, and how wrongdoing impacted moral community of the woman, and what steps were required to restore social harmony. As with Acholi love, understanding rape isn't possible if it's considered as to be just between two people. Both the transitional justice discourse and the domestic and international legal system's inherent fixation on individual victim and perpetrator roles excludes that lived experience of rape and other crime or wrongdoing as social. Thus, any determination of justice from such a perspective can only provide a partial remedy, even if it's fully and efficiently implemented. So used exclusively, that leaves many opportunities for social transformation and doing justice untapped. My time working on this has given me to think that a more fulfilled expression of our humanity becomes possible when we recognize that these times that we draw boundaries around constitute integrated parts of our whole. Thanks.